This is Brian Cambria with news for the Western Slope, Monday, June 17, 2013. The annual meeting of the Delta Montrose Electrical Association focused on the usual difficulties with the co-op's electricity supplier, Tri-State, as well as a new initiative to extend and offer broadband to members. But there was also an emphasis on renewable energy and on the history of the 75-year-old member-owned company. The meeting was held in Memorial Hall in Hotchkiss on Friday, and KVNF's Marty Derlin has more.
Back in 1938, the first board of directors of the precursor to the Delta Montrose Electrical Association had two women serving on it. Today there's only one woman, but she's the president. Nancy Hovde spoke about the boldness of early DMEA directors and compared their visionary actions to those of the current board's decision to build on broadband capacity to provide internet service in Delta and Montrose counties.
On May 28th of this year, after recognizing that DMEA service territory is one of the most underserved areas in the country for broadband, the DMEA board approved spending up to $3.9 million to string fiber optics to DMEA substations. But DMEA realized we're in a unique position where we own fiber assets and can install enough additional capacity over what DMEA needs at a low cost, whereas private industry, just like in the 30s, has been unwilling to make the much-needed investment to improve reliability and lower prices.
As keynote speaker, renewable energy expert Randy Udall praised DMEA's South Canal hydroelectric project and talked about the falling prices of solar and wind energy. But his favorite subject was the methane capture at the West Elk Mine.
In November last year, we had a dedication of the first coal mine methane to electricity project west of the Mississippi, and one of only two in the entire country. This was at the Elk Creek Mine up around Somerset. I think somebody mentioned that the three mines around Somerset produce more than 1% of America's coal. And coal's been mined here for more than 100 years. And the mines have been venting a lot of methane, and they need to do that. No one, has any objection to it. Federal law requires them to do it. But this methane is a powerful greenhouse gas, and it's also a very valuable natural resource. The total methane being vented from the coal mines is worth about, if you could capture it and put it to use, it's worth about $10 million a year. 1 pound of CH4 methane has the same warming impact as 21 pounds of carbon dioxide. So if we really get serious about trying to slow climate change, we're really going to focus as a society on methane much more than we have so far today. Senate Bill 252 that was very controversial didn't really recognize that coal mine methane is actually, from a climate perspective, it's four times better than generating a megawatt hour from wind or solar or biomass. It's the best bang for your buck.
Finally, it was time to hear the election results. They were predictable. For the seat representing the North Fork, outspoken Democrat Ed Marston was defeated by former Republican County Commissioner Olin Lund by more than 1,100 votes. Incumbent Tony Prendergast defeated Kay Hineshow by about 800 votes in the Crawford region, and Jim Elder beat Erica Lewis Kennedy by more than 1,200 votes in the Montrose district. Of the more than 30,000 households in the membership, 6,675 valid ballots were cast in the election, and about 100 people attended the annual meeting. For KVNF News, I'm Marty Derlin.
The Associated Press did an analysis of industry-compiled fracking data and the U.S. Department of Agriculture's official drought resignations. The conclusion? Most of the western counties where fracking is occurring are also suffering from drought. In Colorado, New Mexico, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Texas, Utah, and Wyoming, fracking is increasing competition for water, driving up the price and burdening already depleted aquifers and rivers in drought-stricken stretches. Along Colorado's Front Range, the fourth-generation farmer Kent Pepler said he is fallowing some of his cornfields this year because he can't afford to irrigate the land for the full growing season, in part because deep-pocketed energy companies have driven up the price of water. In a normal year, Pepler said he would pay anywhere from $9 to $100 for an acre-foot of water in auctions held by cities with excess supplies. But these days, energy companies are paying some cities $1,200 to $2,900 per acre-foot. The Denver suburb of Aurora made a $9.5 million five-year deal last summer to provide the oil company Anadarko 2.4 billion gallons of excess treated sewer water. The amount of water needed to hydraulically fracture a well varies greatly, depending upon how hard it is to extract oil and gas from each geological formation. According to estimates by government and trade associations, in Texas, the average well requires up to 6 million gallons of water, while in California, each well requires 80,000 to 300,000 gallons. Depending upon state and local water laws, frackers may draw their water for free from underground aquifers or rivers, or may buy and lease supplies belonging to water districts, cities, and farmers. Some of the industry's largest players are also investing in high-tech water recycling systems to frack with gray or brackish water. Halliburton, for instance, recently started marketing a new technology that allows customers to use recycled wastewater, calling it, quote, an investment to further the sustainable development of the oil and gas industry. The American Petroleum Institute, the principal lobbying group for the industry, said its members are working to become less dependent on fresh water and instead draw on other sources. In Colorado's Weld County, home to Pepler's farm and more than 19,000 active oil and gas wells, some officials see selling unneeded portions of their allotments from the Colorado River as a way to shore up city budgets. The county seat of Greeley sold 1,575 acre-feet of water last year to contractors that supply fracking companies and made about $4.1 million. It sold farmers nearly 100 times more water, but netted just under $400,000. The Telluride Daily Planet reports that the town of Telluride has enacted water restrictions that limit activities like power washing, filling swimming pools, and irrigation. The town issued the water restrictions on Tuesday. Town manager Greg Clifton said they will remain in place until officials determine they are no longer necessary. Clifton said the decision was prompted by a combination of factors, including hot days, a lack of rain, rapidly declining stream flows, and concern about the town's rising water demands. Daily monitoring of the town's water, which is treated at the Mill Creek plant northwest of town, shows that Telluride is getting close to its treatment capacity, he said. And with the Telluride Bluegrass Festival set for next week, demand will only spike. This is the second consecutive year that low stream flows and dry weather have prompted the town to enact water restrictions. According to weather data compiled by Telluride resident and former town councilman Tom Carnival, 0 inches of rain have fallen in June, which has also seen temperatures climb into the 80s on several days. The average precipitation for the month is 1.22 inches. Carnival said May was also drier than normal. According to the Natural Resources Conservation Service, snowpack in the San Miguel, Dolores, Animas, and San Juan River Basin had dropped to 18% of average last week. Now here's an update on state fires that I've culled from a variety of sources. Containment on the Black Forest fire could take until Thursday. The fire has consumed 15,500 acres, 485 homes, and 2 lives. The blaze was 65% contained last night, and authorities were confident all the casualties had been recorded. El Paso County Sheriff Terry Makita said investigators have not yet determined what started the fire, but is likely to have been human-caused. He said investigators are zeroing in on the point of origin and have called in-state and federal ATF experts to help. The two deaths in the fire have been classified as homicides because it has not yet been determined how they died. The Big Meadow Fire, burning in a relatively remote area of Rocky Mountain National Park, about 5 miles north of Grand Lake, was at 600 acres and 60% containment Sunday, burning in an area full of trees killed by bark beetles. A firefighter was taken out by helicopter to a hospital yesterday. Fire managers said the medical emergency was not due to an accident. As of last night, the Royal Gorge Fire is 100% contained at 3,200 acres. The West Fork Fire, about 14 miles northeast of Pagosa Springs, made a significant push Saturday into the Weminuche Wilderness area. The Durango Interagency Fire Dispatch reported the fire grew from 471 to 1,700 acres on Saturday. The fire was started by lightning June 5th and is not currently threatening populated areas. Also in the Durango area, the Windy Pass Fire grew to 108 acres on Saturday. The lightning-caused Ward Gulch Fire has burned about 485 acres on BLM land north of Rifle. Residents that had been evacuated from 12 homes along along Highway 385 were allowed to return home on Sunday. Authorities said yesterday that a fire began as two fires caused by lightning strikes on Wild Mountain in Dinosaur National Monument Park will be allowed to burn for the natural benefits fire provides. The Wild Hacking Fire, which merged Friday, was estimated at 370 acres yesterday, though the exact size of the fire is still imprecise, awaiting better analysis. The fire poses no threat to structures, and the monument remains open, although visitors are asked to avoid the Wild Mountain area. Elsewhere, the Silver Fire in Gila National Forest of southwest New Mexico, east of Silver City, is at 22,500 acres and 5% contained, and threatening the town of Kingston. The human-caused Thompson Ridge Fire is located on the Valles Caldera National Preserve, about 2 miles northeast of La Cueva, New Mexico, and is 80% contained at 24,000 acres. It's a very active fire time right now, similar to last year. Please be careful. The consensus on icy change last week was it's hot, too hot for this time of year, too hot and dry. If climate change experts are right, this situation will only get worse. KVNF's Marty Durlin spoke to Dave Kanzer, senior water resources engineer for the Colorado River Conservation District, about the effects of a hotter, drier world.
The biggest part of Dave Kanzer's job is to help us conserve water, and it's a job that only gets bigger as the drying effects of climate change are felt across the Colorado River Basin.
Climate change is a scary thing. Of course, we have been working with others, including the Bureau of Reclamation, who just finished a multi-year study on this very issue. And projections are not very rosy going down the road. We have observed a drying in the last 20 years below the 100-year observed record. So in other words, we have seen a decrease in available water supplies, and the projections are we will continue to see a decreasing availability of water supplies.
The Colorado River Supply and Demand Study, or the Basin Study as it's known, can be found online at the Bureau of Reclamation's website, usbr.gov.
Some of the results from the Basin Study suggest a decrease of available water in the next 50 years of up to about 10% in the Colorado River Basin. Now, that may not sound like a lot to some listeners, but if that occurs and how it occurs really can impact our ability to utilize water in our ongoing way of life. Now, there are also many options and strategies that were developed in that study to address these drying conditions. Increased use of technology, greater conservation, and even exchanges, creative ways of using our existing supplies. We are, like most irrigators, always optimistic about next year's precipitation and ways to address these issues. We do have Lake Powell, although it's only half full this year and projected to decline a little bit. It provides our bank account and protects our users up in the upper Colorado River Basin against curtailments from the Colorado River Compact. So we have a good system in place. We are very diligently monitoring the situation and trying to make sure every drop of water gets used to its maximum benefit.
Despite the daunting issues, Kanzer remains upbeat about his job and the mission of protecting the Colorado River and helping its users.
It's an amazing system, from the headwaters here in the backyard of Paonia all the way down to the Colorado River Delta, which may see water flowing for the first time in about 10 years through a very interesting cooperative agreement with the Republic of Mexico. There's no shortage of issues and a lot of challenges, some successes, and, you know, we need everybody engaged as we move forward trying to address some of these really challenging issues.
The website is coloradoriverdistrict.org for folks who are interested in what the watershed is and what it might become in the future. For KVNF News and I See Change at thealmanac.org, I'm Marty Derlin.
Are you planning and preparing for the future in a different way? Do you think it's been a hotter than usual June? What is normal anyway? You can let us know by posting at icchange@thealmanac.org. Share your observations or questions. Be a part of it. Be a part of two-way radio at KVNF. Thus concludes today's newscast. For KVNF News, I'm Brian Cambria.